will remember was outstanding in terms of presentations when we last met was a presentation from the ministry regarding best practice, regarding protection of information around the world. And we are going to get a presentation from the ministry on some of the key issues regarding the best practice of the protection of information around the world. That presentation will follow in a jiffy, honorable members. I have apologies here from the honorable Masasiya. He's presently attending another committee meeting. The honorable Delange is at a conference. The honorable Wanders is presently chairing a portfolio committee on justice. The honorable Mania has apologized. He's also occupying today. A written apology. The Honorable Chabaleng is also apologizing. He's presently chairing the Committee on Labor. The Honorable Sadunza has a doctor's appointment and will also not be able to attend the meeting.
Point of order. Thank you. May I move that you be recognized as an appointed as the chairman of this meeting, because it's a new committee which is born without a chairman under the rules. So I think for due process we should appoint, elect, and nominate as chairman.
Honorable members, my understanding of the resolution that those trivialities have been taken into account. But seeing that you so wish, and seeing that there's no objections to this proposal of yours, and seeing that the opposition is keen to have me reappointed as the chair, continue that on that basis, that there was a proposal and the proposal was not opposed. I voice no legal opinion on that proposal. But thank you. Thank you, honorable members. Honorable members, the program for the rest of the week is quite simple. This will be the only committee meeting for the week. The reason is that there are a number of other activities taking place. Tomorrow we have the Deputy President. We also have the Security Cluster in Parliament. Also because of the fact that the committee hasn't sat for some time, other committees have taken the advantage and have organized their programs, and we have to now very carefully look at their programs to see that we don't disrupt committees that have already arranged with other clients of theirs to come and present. But we will let you know by the end of the week what the program is. Next Friday, not this one, the following Friday is meant to be a constituency week, and we have in the meantime made known that we would like to sit on that day to catch up for what we can't do this week. So there might be two sittings in that week. It's not this week, it's the following week. It would be the Friday and some other day. But we will look and also see what your availability is, and then by the end of this week, no later than the end of this week, we will let you know what the program is going to be like for the following weeks. We're also looking at the extended sittings of the budget votes. to see where some of the honorable members are not going to be occupied. Also try to get permission to sit during those time periods too. Honorable members, there are no questions on these announcements, and so I'd like to, in the short time that's left, we all have to get back to the House today. I know there are some honorable members that have got statements they want to make. So without much ado, can we agree without reservation that we hand over to Mr. Dennis Dromo from the Minister's office to allow him to start this presentation anew? I might just add, the Minister has given his full support behind the presentation. He has had a look at it. He's unfortunately, I think, Cabinet is presently meeting as we're sitting, and they are presently, are they going to meet tomorrow again, and for that reason the Minister is not available. He did fly in this morning at 9 o'clock, I understand, but was forced to go to his Cabinet meeting immediately. But Mr. Dennis Dromo has been with us almost from day one, and I'm sure he in any event was going to be the one that was going to present him. So we hand over to you.
Thank you, Chairperson. Good morning, honorable members and everybody present here today. The presentation we are going to give today will be in two parts. The first part, we divided into two, a broad background and an overview of some of the case studies, answering some five questions that we will deal with later. And the second part will focus on the case studies, and then a brief conclusion. Chairperson, the background to this meeting, as they've already pointed out, flows from the presentation made by the Minister on the 22nd of October 2010, where the Minister briefed the Ad Hoc Committee on the Protection of Information Bill. And during that presentation, he, amongst other things, offered to present at the pleasure of the Ad Hoc Committee a study on international best practice. In addition, the committee, following a decision during one of its sittings, asked the ad hoc chairperson to then follow up and take the offer of the minister. And as the chairperson has already indicated this morning, this briefing is being given with the full blessing of the minister. Chairperson, I thought that it would be important to underline that the study has been conducted in response to some of the issues that arose during public hearing. But we've also found it necessary in some areas to adapt it to some of the comments that were made in this committee by some of the honorable members who specifically emphasized issues of timeline that deal with the protection of information. Specifically, that most of the regimes that people have been talking about were made before the 9/11, and we have since chosen to focus also on cases that go beyond 9/11, because there has been a lot of work which has been done by a number of countries that have looked at the protection of information in a post-9/11 world, but more importantly, taking into account the advancement that has been made in the information and communications technology. So we would seek to address some of those issues that honorable members raised concerns about. And the aim would be to ensure that we address some of the issues, pointing out what remains substantively correct or incorrect, or point to other practices that have not yet been highlighted during the public hearing. I thought that it is important to locate this briefing within a human rights perspective. We are not looking at the protection of information outside of the human right perspective. And therefore, what we are going to be talking to would be lessons learned from more than 86 countries that have put in place the right to information laws. And this right to information laws also go hand in hand with information protection laws. Chairperson, I thought that it is important to point out that the majority of the cases that we will be dealing with actually found in, for most parts, in different parts of the world. But the biggest growth that has been taking place on matters pertaining to the right to information are those pertaining to the former Eastern Bloc countries that have been seeking to join the European Union. And so there are a lot of developments that have been taking place, but this has not excluded Africa, as a number of countries, at least five of them, have been dealing with issues of legislation on the protection of information or the advancement of the right to information in those respective countries. So in the overview, Chairperson, we would then be reflecting on the key trends that are emerging. And when we're talking about trends, we take as a point of departure that there has been some academic work which has been led by people such as Toby Mendel, which has built up to the adoption of the Johannesburg Principles. This work is currently being reviewed, and for the benefit of members here, there would be a meeting also, which is to be held here in South Africa, a follow-up to another which was held under the auspices of the ISS and a number of other non-governmental organizations that would actually be looking at best practices when it comes to the protection of information and the advancement of the right to information. I thought that, Chairperson, by way of background, it might be useful to start there. Chairperson, in various dispensations, they seek to answer the question of what is it that they need to protect. In various dispensations, answer this question differently. And the trend is that they seek to protect or to classify information that is associated with, or instruments that is associated with the generation, development, storage, transfer, copying, conveying, protecting, processing, and using information. There are three main approaches that are actually adopted in this regard, informed by the approach a country has towards national security. Now, those countries that are informed in their protection regime by a narrow definition of national security. The others that focus on a broad definition of national security, and a number of these new countries that are emerging democracies are actually focusing on a broad definition of national security, but limits the role of intelligence and security structures, while bringing non-traditional state structure into the advancement and protection of national security. As an example, you would know that traditionally, institutions pertaining to commerce and finance have not really been at the core of the protection of national security or its advancement. But in light of a number of problems that have come to the fore, notably in the post-9/11 world, with the financing of terrorism and a number of those issues, it has brought a finance intelligence centers to the core of the provision of national security. In the case of environmental disasters that we are actually seeing, as in the case of Japan, you would also know that non-traditional departments that have to do with the protection of the environment have also been brought in to be quite key, especially with issues such as climate change requiring special attention at a national security level. So, Chairperson, it is generally said by various authors such as Toby Mendel that in every country there is a legitimate public interest in providing a higher level of protection to sensitive information held by public bodies. Inevitably, such protection constitutes a restriction on the right of access to information. the protected public interests are enacted as exceptions in the freedom of information regime, and even if the needs of such exception to the right to know may vary, but there are some core elements that guide this protection, such as national security, defense of foreign relations, public safety, public order, which are always present. I thought, Chairperson, that it would be in the interest of the committee just to highlight that various dispensations use different things as grounds for the protection of information. But as we have said that from our point of view, we want to emphasize a human rights perspective. We will give you a broad base, and then we will later on focus on what are the parameters that are set by international instruments. So a number of countries, for example, in their laws, seek to provide for the protection of interests of the country. In the case of the United Kingdom, interests of the country are really defined by three main things. It's the economy, it's the ability of the country to make sovereign decisions and to be able to defend itself and to ensure the protection of its values and, where necessary, the advancement of those values. Other countries would actually focus on public interest. And in this instance, the provision of security is viewed as a public interest. In addition, the right of access to information is equally seen as another issue of public interest. And so, in most of these countries, the key issue is ensuring that there is a balance in the way in which these rights are dealt with. Other countries emphasize the protection of vital interests. And again, they define what this vital interest is. The continued existence of the state, it's their economic well-being, it's the safety of the people of that given country, and of course the other issues that I've talked about, their ability to exercise their foreign policy without undue influence from other states. Then in other countries, they emphasize what they term permanent interest. And this is usually informed by how these decisions are arrived at. In most of the countries, you'd find that they've got the bilateral, bipartisan system. And so the two main parties would then, in a bipartisan system, be the ones who agree and set those interest that would then be defined as permanent interest. So it doesn't matter which of the two parties is in power. Those interests will then continue without any change. Others would refer to these as fundamental interests, again following the same process. And the others would actually define these as interests of importance. And then there are others who prefer to use state interests. And lastly, there are other countries who talk about essential interests. I will, when dealing with the individual case studies, give you examples of in which countries do they use what kind of definition so that members could benefit from that. But I think the key issue that I would really like to emphasize is that the bulk of these countries are actually guided by a number of regional values and instruments that provide for some of these protections. We will talk about them again in detail when we focus on the individual case studies later today. Chairperson, I have already highlighted that these interests are enlisted in both international and national legal instruments which provide for the freedom of information and expression. The essence of every secrecy law is that some set of information have to be protected in the interest of the public or country or the nation so as to avoid threats or harm harm which could be caused by the disclosure to unauthorized persons. Who classifies Chairperson is a question that we are also seeking to answer today. Various countries would use different ways of classification. In the main, there are three trends that one can discern. The first is what I have, for purposes of today's presentation, referred to as a prior classification system. And here, the classifying authority determines beforehand what information is going to be classified. Not anybody has got the right of then determining a secret. You have a manual which you have to follow. Once those secrets are set, in the case of the ICT infrastructure, each time you open a computer, as soon as you have determined what category, there is a system that helps you to then determine the classification of the information concerned. There is a system which we refer as the originator, a classification system. What currently obtains with the minimum information security standards in South Africa is that the author of the document is responsible for the classification of the document concerned. And so that would be the system that is basically in place and would require the confirmation of that classification by higher authority. And then you've got what we call the classifying authority system, which basically does two things. There is an originator with the power to classify, and then the derivative authority to classify. So there are two types of classification. Similar to prior classification, there are certain individuals with the power to do the classification. Not everybody can do the classification. And then those people can either delegate to a limited extent that power or create manuals which provide what we call derivative authority to classify. You derive the authority to classify from the information which has already been classified by the originator, the people with the prior authority to classify. Now, Chairperson, in trying to deal with these issues, we ask the question, when is the information classified in this system? For most part, there are countries whose constitution provides that any information held by the state is classified until there is a request to declassify it. And so this is what we would call a classification default system. The information is kept confidential and is not disclosed until the request comes in. And then we would have what we call a multiple layer dispensation, where there are various categories of information, some designated as open and must be given, as we have in the Promotion of Access to Information Act. There is information that must be protected, and there is information that is discretionary. And this system obtains in a number of countries as well. I just want to underscore the fact that in all these systems, the need for the information to be protected has to be proven. It is not a given. Even in the default classification system, you still need to prove why the request must not actually be responded to positively. Where is the information classified? In various systems, Chairperson, the main focus is to ensure that those people who are actually working with information, especially in the security services, that as soon as information is created, that information can be safeguarded in order to save lives of people who are actually involved in information collection, in infiltrating various organizations that are involved in the promotion of unconstitutional activities, etc. And so, in various places, there are provisions for this information to be protected. In the regions where the field agents are operating, in battlefields where defense intelligence operatives would be active. In the case of crime intelligence, those who are seeking to infiltrate crime syndicates of various sorts, and obviously there would also be the power to classify in those people who are working within international organizations. How is the information classified? We've already alluded, Chairperson, that as we are adopting an international, as we are adopting a human rights perspective, we want to locate this again within that paradigm. And so there are various instruments that provide for the protection of information. So international law and jurisprudence would basically provide a guide on how the information is protected. At a national level, there would be constitutional provisions in the various countries. There would also be national laws and subordinate legislation. There would be supportive activities and documents. I emphasize, Chairperson, supportive activities and documents, because in all the systems are only able to work effectively when you actually ensure that there is proper training that is given to the people who are to handle information and to ensure that it is effectively protected and availed where necessary. And so there would be training and advisory services where various systems are utilized. Some countries would use intelligence services. Other countries would use the Office of National Security advisors. Others would make use of information commissioners or regulators. So there are a number of those kinds of offices that would have to deal with work like that. In the main, the security audits tend to be given to the counterintelligence organization of that given country, which will then have to report if there is a National Security Council to the National Security Council, which will then be responsible for approving policies, procedures, and the establishment of manuals of various sorts. Chairperson, with regard to international law, one thought that it is important to highlight that the restrictions are actually provided for in various international instruments. And these flow from, amongst others, the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights, and in the case of Africa, we've got the African Charter for Human and People's Rights, and various regions of the world have an equivalent African Charter on Human and People's Rights. In the Americas, they've got their own. In Europe, they've got their own. And so this is what those regional charters basically provide a guide on how this is to be dealt with. But I just thought that the restrictions, which is what I want to talk about today, in these instruments are supposed at all times to be clearly stipulated by law. And secondly, that law must be precise as to what it is that it seeks to protect. And the attest that goes with this, it is expected that there must be legal certainty and foreseeability that arise from these restrictions, and that these restrictions must be genuinely directed towards achieving one of the legitimate aims that are grounds for the restriction of this access to information. And the key test there is that such a ground must be necessary in a democratic society, and in this regard, there must be a proven or demonstrable social need, and that restriction must equally be proportionate. What are some of these instruments? I've listed them: the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights, the African Charter on Human and People's Rights, the American Convention on Human Rights, and the American Declaration of the Rights and Duties of Men, the European Convention on Human Rights, amongst others. In answering the question of how the information is classified, Chairperson, it is important to highlight that the international best practice is to provide for tests. There are two main tests that are interlined. The first is the harm test, which I'd like to elaborate. And in the main, when dealing with the harm test, there are two elements that we have to look at. Is the gravity on the one hand, and the probability on the other of a result that would flow from unauthorized disclosure. So you need to make sure that those two elements are looked at, gravity and probability. This test does not necessarily apply in all dispensations, but this is the general trend in terms of the best practice. Second is that in this harm test, again, as it will apply in the next test, there must always be the justification of the reason for non-disclosure. There are rare cases, Chairperson, that are also provided for in this harm test, where the sensitivity of the information itself, as is provided in our Promotion of Access to Information Act, those dealing with the information are given the right to neither confirm nor deny the existence of information. And we have heard some of the criticisms that have been made in the public domain that this is a double bind provision. It is part of the international best practice. The second part, Chairperson, is the public interest test. Now, that which is of interest to the public refers to something which is of serious concern or benefit to the public. As we pointed out in our engagement, this does not mean that which is of interest to the public, but that which is in the interest of the public. I'd like just to underscore that. And it arises when access to information is required, where there is a need for the weighing of the for and against factors for disclosure. And lastly, requires that the outcome of that weighing be justified. And so it is not enough to just say you have weighed and therefore have come to this conclusion without spelling out what the reasons for such a conclusion really are. Chairperson, I would like to just underscore that the issue of classification in different dispensations, as I said in the introduction, does not only cover information. It also covers, for example, the classification of weapons themselves, so you might know how to handle the weapon in question, what information can be shared with the general public, etc. And so what I am going to be highlighting as a guide, Chairperson, is that in jurisprudence there are a number of issues now that have been agreed upon as a guide to what is of public interest. In the case of the United Kingdom spy catcher case, the European Court came to the conclusion that information about activities and possible wrongdoing of the security service is in the public interest, and therefore, each time those issues arise, the weighing is required so that a go-ahead may be given if there is possible wrongdoing of the security services involved in the information that is being requested. In the case involving the Sunday Times, again, which was also heard by the European Human Rights Court, the conclusion of the court was that matters including the status of settlement negotiations pertaining to health risks of legal drugs and the locus of legal and moral responsibility for injuries is an issue that needs to be disclosed to the general public in the main once the weighing has been done. The third case involves the criticism of police departments. I would extend this and say security service. The case was about criticism of the police, but the best practice that flowed from that case was that it is important to look at issues that are done without prejudice. Criticism that flows without prejudice from the activities of the security services. And then again, the Bafford case said that issues that are published pertaining or alleging a court's lack of impartiality are in the public interest. And when there are those debates, those who write about those issues must be protected and have the right to be on record. Tepperson, I just thought that so that the issue of relevance remains, that these tests that we've talked about also talk to some of the provisions of our own constitution. And so some of the tests are relevant to the provisions, especially when it comes to the limitation of rights in our own constitution. An area, Jefferson, on which I thought is important just to spend a little more more time with regard to this overview pertains to the review systems and the elements that are involved in it. And basically, there would be in the main four drivers of review. There's what we call regular reviews. If you take the bill that the committee is currently dealing with, there is a provision that after every 10 years, there must be a review. There are also reviews that are done by the people who are responsible for the management of the system. And an important element of this is the use of what we call random checks. And this involves going to do inspection to check if those who are supposed to classify information are classifying it, those who are supposed to keep information in the public domain are indeed keeping that which is supposed to be in the public domain in that domain. And so it becomes a very useful instrument. The third element is what we call self-tasking review. This is when there has been, say, a security breach or a failure of the system in one way or another. You then task yourself with the responsibility of reviewing how the system is basically operating. And then there are reviews that follow the request for access to information, and in some instances when the information is classified, systems deliberately provide for the review of the classification utilized. Jefferson, with regard to the review outcome, in the main, the classification levels and the period of classification may be changed, may be maintained. There can be a lowering of the grading of the information, and the information may be declassified and put in the public domain. There are usually responsibilities that flow from this, depending on what system you're dealing with. In the originator system, it is the responsibility of the originator of the information, once the classification has been reviewed, to inform others and to make sure that that which is in the public domain is kept in that domain and that people have free access to such information. There are various time frames that are followed up with regard to the review of information. And we emphasize, Chaturthi, that classification is a restriction of the right of access to information. And for this right to exist and be meaningful and to avoid emptying it, there needs to be a period of time in which that information becomes accessible. So the two drivers for the review, it's the end of the specified period. And the second, again, we go back to the harm test. We say the probability and the gravity of the harm. When it has lessened, it obviously must lead to the lowering of the classification level and, in some instances, making the information available in the public domain. Chairperson, we emphasize that it is the sensitivity of information that is directly related to the time frame for it being protected. As soon as there is a change, there is no longer a need to do this, and various countries use different time frames. There are countries that keep information forever classified. Others have varying time frames, such as in Lithuania, they've got the maximum of 95 years, and the others you would see depending on where this is. I just want to underline that the tendency of the information to have shorter periods of classification is mostly found in international organizations. This is largely because the issues that are dealt with at that level tend to require concentrated attention and, in most instances, the quest for a resolution. And so the situation requires that that classification be reviewed regularly in order to make the information available. I can indicate that if you look at the situation in Mauritania, the African Union has been preoccupied with developments in Mauritania following the coups that took place there. The same thing happened in Niger. But as we speak, those countries have now addressed the problems they had. And so the information which was previously classified top secret and not made available is now declassified and made available, and it's part of the briefing that you hear being made by the leadership of the African Union from time to time. Chairperson, I thought that it's important to underscore that there's a certain type of information that in all dispensations is protected forever, and law demands that it should be protected forever. This pertains to information about sources, methods of security services, those sensitivities. The only exception, I mean, to this rule has been in the former Eastern Bloc countries. You would recall, Chairperson, that when Germany was reunited, a number of the former East German sources and were exposed because those archives were actually made available to the public. And so, in the main, it goes hand in hand with the nature of human rights violations that were conducted in the period before a new system is put in place that tends to open up everything. And this also applies in a number of former Eastern Bloc countries where they went the route of opening up the archives. I suspect, Chairperson, that with the recent dissolution in Egypt of their state security service, there is a lot of debate about how to handle those archives that is currently taking place, and only time will tell on how they would to resolve this challenge. Chairperson, information which is classified requires that people who have access to it continue to keep the information protected. And so the main source of access to information is a security clearance, which would then grant access. Or in some countries, it is election to a public office. These are the two main trends that determine access to information. Either you are an elected public official, public representative, or an official who gets a security clearance. There are systems where the security clearance cuts across public officials and those who are elected, as we have in the case here in South Africa of the membership of the Joint Standing Committee on Intelligence. We're not the only ones who do that. There are a number of other countries that require a security clearance before you can have access to classified information. And so, in the main, those who have got the top secret security clearance, guided by the right to know, are given access to all the information that is relevant to their work. I would like to emphasize that the access of a top security clearance does not mean that I can visit the various state departments demanding top secret information. It is only that which is relevant to my work and that which can be justified in terms of the work that I'm actually doing, or any other person for that matter. There is also partial access, and here with partial access, you either have access to, let me say this point now. If you've got a top secret security clearance, it means you can have access to top secret information and all the other categories. In the case of a secret security clearance, you can only have from secret to confidential and restricted, depending on the system. I am going to elaborate on some of the systems because a number of systems have got more classification levels than you see here. And I will share some of this. There is also conditional access to information, where a person does not necessarily have a security clearance, but that somebody can vouch for you, that you can be trusted, and for the purpose of that particular project, you can then be given information. In the main, this is done with some of the contractors that are brought on board, or those who are, again, holding elected public office. Chairperson, I'd like to move to the case study. And as I said,
just hold on. This is the second part now.
Yes.
That you want to move on to. Perhaps I can just pause here for a minute and hear whether the honorable members have any questions of clarity here, so that we don't burden them with too much thinking at the end of this process. Honorable members, remember, points of clarity is not a point of view that Mr. Gloomer is carrying himself. I recognize the professor here, and then the Honorable Sisman.
Thank you, Chairperson. Just want to obtain more clarity on concepts of traditional and non-traditional. The interests of the country versus public interest and rights of the country, and the relationship between these and human rights in general, including the idea of adopting a human rights perspective as you expressed it. Thank you, Chairperson.
Perhaps you'll take that mouthful, Mr. Dilma, first, and then we'll get back to the Honorable Smith and the Honorable Mentor after that.
Chairperson, in the traditional understanding of security, security mainly pertains to the military defense of the country and does not tend to include, has since been, matters pertaining to environmental security, issues of food security. These have not been traditional concepts associated with national security. This actually has been driven in the main by the work that was done by the high-level panel, which was set up by the then Secretary General of the United Nations, Mr. Kofi Annan. The panel looked at various issues in the world, amongst others, the approach that was being adopted towards national security, and even went on to come up with a new concept of human security, and a further commission which included our former speaker, Dr. Frene Ginwala, was then constituted to look further as to what is meant by this concept of human security. And so when we're talking about traditional understanding of what national security is, we refer to the understanding of the narrow definition of security as opposed to what is now non-traditional, which is human security, or what we would call the broad understanding of national security. Chairperson, traditionally, national security has actually been utilized in repressive societies to deny people their legitimate and hard-earned rights. And the problem that has been associated with that is that as soon as you call on national security, you would not have the need to explain further, which is why you'd find in a number of countries the traditional answer in the case of the United Kingdom when dealing with issues of national security. If you ask a question in Parliament, there's a traditional answer. It is the policy of His Majesty's government not to comment on matters of national security. So the development from a human rights perspective has sought to remind people that the Universal Declaration on Human Rights provides for the limitation of rights. But you would recall that in the initial stages, these limitations did not have clear guidance, which is why we have, in this presentation, addressed issues of the jurisprudence that has flowed from that. Because documents such as the Johannesburg Principles on national security and access to information, they looked at what are the judgments in different countries and what is it that is best that can guide those who are making laws or those who are adjudicating cases in the case of the judiciary, in order to make sure that they do this without well understood and very, very clear parameters. And so the issue of public interest has then been brought to the fore. It is for this reason that in the presentation I highlighted what are some of the cases and what are the principles that flow from them that actually show you what it is that can now be availed in the public interest. That's why I also pointed out that national security itself is part of the public interest, but in given instances, when there are competing rights, there is a need to weigh and balance, because there would be justified instances where classified information must be put in the public domain because it will be in the greater public interest for the public to know than to keep that information classified. And so it is that balance that we are advocating. It would not have been any other perspective, Chairperson, that one would have had to adopt, because our Constitution in Chapter 11 does oblige the security services to do their work in the context of our own national laws, guided by those laws, but importantly, international law as well, and expressly provides that we should not accept illegal instruction. So there is no other way of dealing with it, because if it is not within a human rights perspective, then we would be going against the provisions of the Bill of Rights, which is in our Constitution. And so that's why we emphasize and are adamant that if we are to deal with this issue effectively, We can only deal with it effectively within a human rights perspective.
Honorable,
thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Drummond. On your page 4, the little window at the top right-hand corner, and I commence questions here now exactly on the subject that you have just left. The fact that our constitution expressly and in so many words requires us to accord with the international law, which includes the ICCPR, as you said, inter alia, and the African Charter. Now, since it is the case that the ICCPR and other instruments say that you can only limit right of access to information when it is necessary, the necessity test which you reflect in your third last bullet point, when it is necessary for national security, order of public, and something else which I forget. Since that's the case, why do you in that little window refer to a social need? You said quite correctly that you can classify when it is necessary for what you then called a demonstrable social need, which must be proportionate. And I would just like to understand why you describe this as a social need, because the grounds upon which you can limit and classify in the international instrument is security, national security, order public, and you will remind me what the other one is. That's good morals. It is good morals. All right, so it's good morals, but that doesn't mean that it's a social need. So I'm simply just a clarification question. You are not here excluding national security, are you? It must be necessary in a democratic society where there's a demonstrable need, not only social. National security is not a social need, and which must be proportionate. That's the first question. And the second one over the page, 5. You've set out how a public interest test works, and you say that a public interest test is always arises when access to information is asked. I would just like to ask, since you are doing for us comparative work, and which is, by the way, very useful. This is very good. Your presentation is very good to have. May I ask whether you have encountered in any other jurisdiction, over and above the public interest test which is triggered by a request for access to information, have you encountered anywhere a public interest defense which anybody might be able to use in court? Is there such a thing anywhere else? And lastly, just on your page 7, top right hand, where you told us Lithuania has the longest time frame at 95 years and so forth. The last 5 items, to which countries do they refer? 4 items. After 12 years extendable in Mexico, to what do the last 4 items refer? 5 years for top secret, 4 for secret, 3 for confidential, 2 for restricted. Does that relate to a country? If so, which? If not, what is it they refer to?
With regards to the first question from the Honourable Member Chairperson, indeed, the issue of social need is defined by people differently. It flows from the original provision in the Universal Declaration on Human Rights, which is the restriction, amongst others, on moral, the moral grounds. Now, the various authors deal with this thing of social need in differently. Others would see, contrary to the approach adopted by the Honourable Member Chairperson, that issues of national security, because security is a service that is provided to society. and that the existence of society, if you take the social contract theorists, who would argue that the basis for the existence of the state is actually the provision of this right, which is security, and always quote somebody who said that life in this unregulated society is brutish, nasty, and short. So to avoid this brutish, nasty, and short life, security becomes a very important public good that must be accessed by everybody. And a number of people who belong to the school of thought, actually, are at the forefront of the movement, which is opposed to the privatization of security, because they are of the view that it is this privatization of security that gives rise to unequal treatment of people, and therefore denies them their very fundamental right to life, which is the basis on which you can then enjoy all other rights, because when you are dead, those other rights are no longer useful to you. So that would be the approach that they would take, Honorable Chairperson. With regard to the second question, I am going to deal with this issue when I'm looking into the case of Canada, of public interest defense. But I can allude here, Chairperson, by pointing out that in the United Kingdom, which was the first country to have public interest defense, they have since amended that provision for public interest defense. In the case of Canada, it only applies to those people who are under permanent secrecy. But we will, when dealing with the case of Canada, expand on that question. But indeed, there are dispensations that have that. I'm made to believe that Germany has it, but I have looked all over. I have not found a single authority that has been able to confirm the existence of this. I have attributed that to the fact that I did an English search. I will try a German search and see if there is something that we can get in that regard. But I would like to keep that as work in progress, Chairman. The last one, Chairperson, I have looked at various dispensations. I would like to speak under correction here. I'm not absolutely certain. I know that it is one of the Eastern Bloc countries. Either in the Czech Republic or in Slovenia. I have the authority here. When I've done doing the presentation, I will go to that slide and then provide the information at a later stage.
Thanks.
The Honourable Minto.
Chairperson, I hope I'll be correct to presume that insofar as who classifies is concerned, the originator is not the person but the office or the title. Because if it is not the case, when that originator is no longer there and time for declassification or review comes, then there will be a problem. So I just want you to emphasize, to clarify whether my interpretation is okay in terms of the originator of classification. Chair, one clarity question. The clarity that I'm seeking is quite very broad and will not be fully responded to in this meeting. If the chair and the meeting and Mr. Zomo agrees, it will require another discussion at another time. I'm aware of the time constraints that we have in terms of the committee having to report by the 24th of June. You see, it's good to do all these benchmarks, international benchmarks. But I thought that the last leg of locating this exercise of this bill would be within the framework of our definition as a country of national security, which is not putting state security over and above human security, but which is seeking to balance state security with human security. So I think that should be the last leg of locating this exercise, having studied the international scenario, locating this within our, so that we don't have to, Mr. Domo, later on, when there is national security doctrine in place, we'll find that there are clashes between this that we have done and that which we will be doing at that stage. So that would be my long-term security clearance-seeking question. My last one. Where you have listed the length of classification, Hungary, Sweden, and all those things, I wish you could have done a little bit of work to demonstrate to us whether, in terms of classification, whether there is any justification or to the fears that classifying information, or the longer you classify or the more you classify, could hamper or threaten human rights. But I wanted to know where there is a length of classification. Is there an obvious emerging relationship or a semblance of state stability, human progress, human development, so that we once and for all answer the fears, whether they are legitimate or whether they are not legitimate. So I don't know if the timeline of completing this work as this committee will allow just that little bit of a test on if there is any relationship. If you take Sweden, for instance, we know Sweden is a very stable country. We know Sweden is very developed. We know human securities are quite secured in Sweden. But can we derive that, can we argue safely that there is a relationship between that kind of stability with classification of information? So I know it's a tall order that I'm asking for. If not, if the meeting feels that it will be too unnecessary and too lengthy, it's information that I could solicit between myself and you, Mr. Domo, just to satisfy myself whether there is any relationship between the nature and length of classification, human progress, human development, and stability in terms of the state and the people.
And not only is it a tall order.
On a point of order.
Yes, sir. The point of order is that my esteemed friend and colleague Frankie is, I think she's out of order in the two last questions she asked, and she's already very elegantly acknowledged as much by saying she could talk separately. But the idea was not to, she was heading in the direction of interrogating the content of the bill before us. When she said what the definition of national security should be here, that's not what we've asked Mr. Loma to do. He's here because some of us specifically asked that the minister's offer of a presentation should be taken up on comparative law. So therefore, it's not appropriate at this point to ask Mr. Loma's view on what our definition of national security ought to be. Neither is it proper to ask him whether a nice, calm country like Sweden is any use as a comparator for South Africa. We asked him to come and do comparative law. So it's in your hands, Chair.
I can ask more.
Honourable members, please. The question as to whether the length of classification, whether there exists a relationship with stability in a particular country, I think such a question is in order. And I can see where the honourable member is coming from. The fact that she mentioned Sweden, I don't think has any specific significance. I think the perception is that because certain countries are over-classifying, it it leads to a perception of dictatorship, and whether those dictatorships in the long run become unstable because of Islam below, and that's what the Honourable Member. And so I would rule that the question, and I'm almost sure that Mr. Dlamo will have no difficulty answering that question. Where Mr. Dlamo is asked to give personal opinion on matters, I wrote down the questions. I'm not sure whether the mentor was asking, but if it was, then Mr. Dlamo, you would restrict yourself to the work at hand and answer what the committee had mandated you to do. I think there would be nothing wrong getting your personal opinion, but I think we would leave that for once we have determined exactly what it is that you researched and what it is you bring into the committee. Yes, over to you, Mr. Dlamo.
Chairperson, guided by your ruling, and I just thought that as an anecdote, I should quote this instance. A lot of researchers actually point out that in open democratic society where information is freely available, there has never been famine. And I thought that from a food security and a human security perspective, that was quite telling. Let me give another anecdotal example. Before the Indian government adopted the right to information law, they had a lot of problems with regards to assisting indigents with basic rights and services that the government was providing. And as soon as this law came into place, especially at local government level, a marked improvement was noted with regards to access to services, and importantly, the way in which non-governmental organizations had sprouted with the view to assisting those indigents were actually beginning to have meaningful breakthroughs and victories in getting people registered for all sorts of social security services that the government provides. So there is demonstrable evidence that supports, you know, the importance balance between the protection of national security on the one hand and ensuring that people have got access to information that enables them to exercise their rights within the state. But there are interesting cases, Chairperson, when you look at advanced democracy. In some research which I conducted on intelligence oversight, one of the most interesting findings that we came to was that in most of these countries, if you do not ensure that the parliamentary oversight structures have got adequate access to information, I don't want to say unlimited, I'll say adequate access to information, they are not able to carry out their work effectively. So you would note that the Iran-Contra scandal took place when you actually had oversight committees in both houses of parliament, purely because the outdated notion of allowing covert action to be undertaken without the approval of parliament made it possible for that to take place. And as one of the lessons that have been learned from that particular instance was that covert action may be undertaken by the president, provided that the president would inform both houses within a given period. I think, if I remember very well, it's within 48 hours. So after he has given authority, I suspect that, as many would know, there is currently a debate about whether the strikes in Libya conform to that provision. I suspect that he's making, the President of the United States still making use of that space to then go and brief the committees. But it is already an issue in the public domain. I thought that, you know, for relevance and contemporary examples, it's helpful just to show how these reinforce each other and assist in effective governance. Yes, Chairperson, there's actually a very interesting, which is my last comment, there's a very interesting development in the case of China. China has actually come up with a right to access, right to information law, and has actually written detailed guidelines that are seen by many as groundbreaking, which is quite interesting. So I suspect that the Twitter revolutions and the Facebook revolutions and the SMS revolutions have an impact not just in the Middle East and Africa, but they also are beginning to influence thinking elsewhere across the globe. So, as a conclusion, Chairperson, it is no longer enough to just look at democratic countries. We actually need to look at what is in place, what is the practice, and draw from those practices what is best, and learn from those in order to ensure that there is effective advance in terms of ensuring the balance. Thanks.
The only thing is the office, the table.
Yes. With regards, yes, the answer to that question, Chairperson, through you, is that it is the office. But remember that in the case of the United States, what I talked to earlier on, it is also the individual. It is only when the individual, for example, supposing that I had a responsibility of classifying information, when I'm briefing here and there is somebody acting in the office, that person would not have the right in some dispensation of exercising the full authority of the office, because I'm still there. They want to avoid a situation where somebody was acting, because there are very, very stringent rules in the case of the United States. If you have not been trained for a period of longer than 2 years, you are not allowed to do top secret classification, full stop. You lose the right to classify. I think that's for secret, sorry. For top secret, you have to go to an annual training. And if you have not participated in that upgrading of classifying authorities, you are not allowed to exercise. So you actually get suspended from the panel of people who do classification. So the answer, in short, is yes, it is the office, but for as long as the incumbent is there and not disabled, not anybody who is acting in the office is able. Only when somebody has been replaced does the responsibility to review information that include a period when the person was not there obtained. This is their way of ensuring consistency, because as the honorable members would know, giving to human beings a discretion, you are most likely to find two different decisions that they actually arrived at in evaluating the same information at their disposal. Thank you.
Yes, Mr. Bloomer, thank you very much. I think you can go on now, part two. Let's see how far you get. I might have to stop you in the process. but United Kingdom, and then I think you're going on to Croatia. Let's see how far you get. I might have to intervene in the process.
Chairperson, I'm willing to do. I can do three case studies and conclude.
And we can also agree then not to ask questions, so that in the interest of
free. No, I think you proceed on the basis in which you have proceeded, fast but nice, and so that we are able to capture your reasoning. And let's see how far we go if you move at your normal speed, and then, you know, I'll look at the matter and decide on the matter as and when we get there. I don't want to say three and then you rush, and, you know, so let's just see how far we get.
In the case of the United Kingdom, I just thought that it would be useful to give an overview. In my presentation, I started by highlighting what are the current criticisms that people have raised about the dispensation in the United Kingdom. So I won't go there. I will just talk about what the system is like at present. The United Kingdom, Chairperson, is guided by legislative obviously from an international perspective, guided by the international instruments I talked about, but it then has, at a domestic level, I think it's now four, and these laws are increasing. I've mentioned three, but when I went back to do an update, I have discovered that there are now four. The first one is the Official Secrets Act of 1911 to 1989. The second is the Data Protection Act of 1998. And the third is the Freedom of Information Act of 2000. They now have a Whistleblowers Act that they've just put in place. And in addition, they've also come up with an Environmental Protection Act. Environmental Information Act, which guides access to information pertaining to environmental matters. This is then translated into an operational document called Her Majesty's Government Security Policy Framework, an equivalent of what we can refer to here in South Africa as the Minimum Information Security Standard. This policy framework provides guidance on the creation, storage, transmission, and destruction of information, and provides that the Prime Minister and government and cabinet, have the overall security responsibility, and delegates elements of this responsibility to heads of department, and emphasizes that security is the responsibility of everyone. Not just those in the public service, but everybody within the United Kingdom. And the emphasis that they put is on the protection of assets. Now, I've already hinted at this when I said it's not only information that they protect. And the definition of assets would include the buildings of the government, the employees of government, the leaders in government, the information that drives the work of the government, and of course, weapon systems and a number of those issues. I am going to elaborate just now. This policy chapter highlights, contrary to the traditional approach which was adopted by the UK government of viewing security as a support function, the paradigm shift is to look at security as a business enabler. You cannot do your work unless there is security. I think that those of us who were privy to the problem that were associated with the early years of the presidential project during the time of President Mandela, pertaining to the RDP, sorry, the, what do you call it, those presidential lead projects. You, the first lesson that we learned with not taking security as a business enabler was that areas were identified for the building of clinics, they procured a lot of resources, and put all the things where they were supposed to be, and the communities found sand, they found gravel stones, and found all these things which they needed, because they were not protected, there was no security provided, there were no fences that were in place. And so, a lot of these projects actually got delayed because there was foraging that was taking place from these public entities, because they just saw security not as a business enabler, and those projects in some instances never saw the light of day. Some of the issues pertaining to the Masakane campaign, the Asaya, can be better understood from this lack of seeing security as a business enabler, but just as an adjunct function. So this policy changes that and seek to ensure that everybody in government takes responsibility for security, number one, but number two, changes the approach to security and sees it as part of business enabler. The five core security principles that this policy actually advocates: to ensure that there is accountability at senior level, there is collective responsibility of all staff and contractors, and the need to employ trustworthy individuals. And there is therefore a document which guides all other departments about what are the minimum standards. These minimum standards, you would recall I talked about spot checks as part of reviewing the effectiveness of the system. It is these minimum standards that people have to then test. But over and above that, every department or organ of state is expected to then look at what are department-specific risks that require additional protection measures over and above these minimum standards that are actually provided for in the policy. And there are seven sub-policies that go hand in hand with this. The first one deals with governance, risk management, and compliance. The second looks at protective marking and asset control. The third looks at personnel security. This provides for things like vetting. Looks at information security and assurance, talking about the measures that must be taken to protect the information. And then there is a manual that guides physical security measures that must be put in place, provision of safe, ensuring that there are strong rooms, if there is a need for a strong room, parameter fencing when there is a need for parameter fencing, and then deployment of people who are going to walk the beat to ensure that security is provided and no intrusion takes place. There are then provisions for counter-terrorism and counter-terrorism measures. There's a manual that guides what needs to be in place. What do you do if somebody phones and say there is a bomb in this room? Do we start running out? What are the steps? What does the person who is getting the phone call do? All of those issues are dealt with in your counter-terrorism manual. And lastly, is the business continuity model. This chapter talks to that part in the bill of protecting information against loss. And here they will then put in place guidelines of what do you do to make sure you do not lose information. And so you'd find that in the case of the US, for example, as part of their business continuity measure, as soon as you open a computer and you type something, you have no right of deleting that document, even though you might be the person who might have started writing. So it automatically gets backed up in order to avoid the information being lost. and you will then have to provide a justification as to why you would want to delete the information and concern. I move, Chairperson, with your guidance to Croatia. Chairperson, Croatia classifies information that pertains to national security and vital interests of Croatia. This would, amongst other things, include the protection of the structure of the state as laid down in the Constitution. I'm not saying protecting information pertaining to the structure. I'm saying the protection of the structure of the state. So when they talk about unconstitutional activities, it is anything that seeks to change the structures of Croatia that are laid down in the Constitution by unconstitutional means. And that becomes part of the mandate of their security services. And they argue that key in what is to be protected is the independence, integrity, and security of Croatia. They also protect international relations of Croatia and the capability, the defense capability of Croatia and their security intelligence system. They protect public security, and importantly, they are of the view that there is a need for the protection of the basis of their economic and financial system. And then scientific discoveries, invention, and technologies that are of great significance for the national security of Croatia. The scope of protection includes the following entities: defense, security, intelligence system, the foreign affairs, the public security, criminal proceedings, and science, technology, public finances, and economy that impacts on the security interest of Croatia. When it comes to the classification, Chairperson, they use the originator who determines, and here is the guide, the lowest degree of secrecy that will secure the interest. The lowest, not the highest, the lowest. This is a common practice. You look at the minimum security required, not the maximum. The minimum security which is required to protect information. And that threshold, Chairperson, is very important because it enables you to balance that which needs to be in the public domain and that which needs to be protected. And so when you are doing the way, this ensures that you are not dealing with that which is of very highly protected and therefore cannot be easily disclosed. Who then does this classification, Chairperson? Top secret and secret information may be specified by the President of Croatia, the President of the Parliament of Croatia, and the President of the Government of Croatia. These are different positions. So the President of the country, then the President of Parliament, and then the President of the Government of Croatia. Then they've got Chief State Attorney, the Head of the General Staff of the Armed Forces, then the head of authorities of the security intelligence system, and those individuals who are delegated by all the above-mentioned people within the scope of their work in writing. Confidential and restricted classification may be prescribed by all the above-mentioned people and the head of other state authorities. The distinction here, Chairperson, is that in our case, you would then have the security services, as mentioned in Chapter 11 of the Constitution, having the right of determining top secret and secret information, and all the other state departments, organs of state as we are talking about them, would only be allowed to do confidential and restricted information. In terms of classification. And then, when it comes to state entities or public entities that are associated with departments, they do not have the power to classify. The classification is determined by the head of the organ of state concern and all of the people that I've mentioned above. So, in using another language, they can only exercise derivative classification authority. They do not have the authority in their own right. When is the information in their instance classified? It's at the point of creation or where the information is actually received. I must underscore here the point, Chairperson, that in the case of Croatia, because they are part of the European Union, they also get information by virtue of being members of the European Union. And so when the information is being shared with them, they are actually expected, in terms of their own guidelines, to follow some of the classifications that are set by those who give them the information, and they just have to domesticate those for purposes of their own guidance. And the main reason, Chairperson, why they would do the classification is really to secure their national security and the vital interests of the Republic of Croatia, and to address the details of the threats to national security that calls for the protection of the information in question. They also follow, as a way of classifying, the harm test by being guided by the lowest degree of secrecy that is needed to protect their interests. In addition, they use the right to know, which means that everybody has got access to the classified information except where it is relevant to the work that they do. And then personal security clearance is a prerequisite for access to information, and the oversight in this instance is done by the Office of the National Security Council. Even if there are appeals, all of those issues are dealt with by the Office of the National Security Council. The case of the United States, I think Jefferson is really known to many. Yes.
One of the members, in your own interest, I know the House is sitting for quite a long period today, sitting till 6. And we have been at work for some time here now. Wouldn't one consider the honourable members to fall asleep in the House? I know there are some members that are also making statements. So allow me to stop Mr. King here now. If there are any questions, take maybe just a few questions for 5 minutes or so. But it's quite clear we're not going to finish today, and we will have to come back for the better part of the presentation, which is also very interesting because I think the latter part deals with Canada and the United States. I'm sure there will be much more questions there because the two systems are so vastly different, although the national security interests seem to be the same. So, honourable members will have an opportunity then to also ask questions on the whole presentation. But if there are any questions of clarity that the honourable members want now, I will allow that for a few minutes. Otherwise, I'd want to adjourn and allow those of you that still have some things to do before you go to the House, want to get some additional food that you want to perhaps look at. And then just on the understanding also that I will notify you, the staff will notify you of the next meeting. I'm just trying, it will not be this week, let there be a clear understanding that it's going to be difficult, it's a short week, and on Friday there is a special workshop for chairpersons. That leaves us just tomorrow and Thursday in this caucus and things, and so it's going to be difficult. So we'll meet next week sometime, and you will be notified if that's okay, and then it's honorable.
Thank you very much. I've really enjoyed this, and I would enjoy coming back to it. But just on the subject of next week, it can only be Friday from my point of view, and I speak also for the other justice people. We are taking on Tuesday and Wednesday budget hearings, respectively the DOJ, NPA, and even Thursday afternoon we sit with legal aid. So I don't think, Prof, I think our week is full up for justice. We can't miss the budget interrogation. Friday, however, is good.
I will look at the slides with the chairperson of justice and all the relevant authorities and those people that have an interest in seeing that the work of formament gets done, and you will be notified about the next sitting. Honourable members, this meeting is then adjourned.
Thank you very much.
Oh, no.